This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. To hear it from the right-wing media, a new red menace is upon us.
My gosh, socialism has never failed so vividly as it has in the modern times, and yet these guys come out there and say, that's what America needs. I don't think so.
Venezuela is currently one of the most dangerous places on earth. Hunger and crime are rampant. Clean water and medicine, scarce. So why on earth would anybody want to bring those catastrophic policies and conditions to the U.S.?
The New York Times hailing in a new op-ed, quote, the millennial socialists are coming.
After Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's primary victory earlier this month in New York, the media and the political establishment are reckoning with the specter of a particular brand of left-wing politics.
Democratic socialism, to me, is the basic belief that in a moral and wealthy America, in a moral and modern America, no person should be too poor to live in this country.
In March, the Washington Post ran an op-ed by its staff columnist and avowed socialist Elizabeth Brunig called It's Time to Give Socialism a Try. This week in the Miami Herald, the op-ed headline, they called themselves socialists, but they don't know the meaning of the word. And on ABC's The View, this exchange.
This is what I need from her. Name one country that socialism has ever worked, and also every Democratic socialist
Copenhagen,
who is going on TV
Denmark,
saying that it's good needs
Norway,
to start paying
Finland,
90% in taxes.
Iceland.
On your tax form. No, on your tax form.
Socialism, an idea once relegated to the kind of far-left newspapers given out at campus conferences, has become fodder for daytime talk shows. A clear offering in the marketplace of ideas, though its adherents might prefer to think of it as simply an idea whose time has come. Nathan Robinson is editor-in-chief at Current Affairs magazine and a self-described socialist. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be with you.
This is a word watch to define socialism, which is kind of like having a word watch to define meat.
It's
There's
true.
A lot of different kinds of meat.
So it's not just like describing meat, it's like describing a lot of abstract terms like love, democracy, liberalism. Broadly, socialism describes a left economic tendency. There are things that nearly all socialists agree on: a skepticism of the concentration of economic power in a few hands, a belief that working people, laborers, need more control over their workplaces, need more ownership over their lives, a broad skepticism of capitalists and landlords. But then what you're going to do about that, there are huge raging arguments among socialists and have been for centuries.
It's fair to say, I suppose, that the common thread is taking care of the many, even at some risk of arguable unfairness to the few.
Yes, and a belief that fairness itself requires justice to all, and there's an egalitarian instinct to it, you know, the fair distribution of resources.
Part of that definition would include status quo, public policy, like Medicare. What parts of the status quo do reflect that kind of socialist worldview?
Well, the parts that guarantee people a basic standard of living and are accessible to all. I just read an article about public libraries and why socialists love public libraries. They are places that are free for everybody. They're controlled by the local people who have authority over them. They're not controlled by a company. And there's that sense of everyone is equal in a public library.
Although it does, to some, seem fearsome. It's the kind of socialism that is usually prefixed with the word creeping.
Well, public libraries embody an egalitarian spirit, and they do sort of challenge the perspective that almost everything other than basic services like police and the military should be left to the market. And public libraries show an example of a well-run state institution. They kind of prove something which is a little dangerous to a certain kind of a free market orthodoxy, which is that they suggest that state-run institutions aren't necessarily a nightmare. So the public library kind of provides a vision of a way that common ownership and common control could work. So I don't think they're necessarily wrong to view it as creeping. I think it does creep.
It's actually not the answer I was expecting.
Oh, sorry.
What I thought you were going to say was, look, yes, but no, because libraries are not collectivism. But this gets to the very point. I guess the fact that there is a relationship is precisely the thing that scares so many people, such as during the Red Scare. Although Soviet communism really isn't the thing that is the big talking point nowadays on the right, it seems to be Venezuela.
You know, as we look at other countries like Venezuela, et cetera, where socialism is imploding their country, do we really want that here?
What happened in Venezuela? They call that democratic socialism, but they don't have toilet paper.
Note to socialism fans, go visit Venezuela.
The fact that a country calls itself socialist, it doesn't really tell you anything. North Korea calls itself a democracy. You have to look at how the country actually operates. For those of us who are democratic socialists, who are very strongly anti-authoritarian, who are skeptical of the concentration of unaccountable power, Venezuela doesn't tell you much at all, because we oppose every measure that would increase centralized and dictatorial power. This isn't a verdict on whether people should have democratic control over their workplaces. They don't have that in Venezuela, just like they didn't have it in the USSR. And that's why there were a lot of libertarian socialists, people like Bertrand Russell and Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, were all horrified by the Soviet Union. Emma Goldman wrote an essay, "There is no communism in Russia." Her whole idea was, well, it only exists if people are actually equal, and equality was a lie in the Soviet Union. So it doesn't invalidate the idea of equality. What it invalidates is using authoritarian methods to sort of impose the illusion of equality on people by force.
A moment ago, we played a clip from Fox and Friends to show their horror at the word socialism, but you don't have to go to the propaganda mouthpiece of the Trump White House to get that reaction. Here's a clip from CBS in which Nancy Pelosi was asked to respond to Republicans who say that Democratic socialists are ascendant in her party.
No, they're not. It's ascendant in that district, perhaps, but I don't accept any characterization of our party presented by the Republicans.
The Democrats are terrified of the word, too. Why?
Well, I think some of them sincerely believe that from a pragmatic perspective, they have to distance themselves from that word because, you know, especially for older Democrats, they remember the Cold War. They think that America has been trained for a century to be horrified by this concept. But I think they don't understand. People in my generation have had to witness an economy that has crushed so many of our peers in debt and in hopelessness. We want a different word, and we want something that can help to distinguish the values that we're putting forward from the values that have built the economy that we see treating people so badly.
Well, on the one hand, Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, got within a hair's breadth of the Democratic nomination, while being unabashedly a socialist. On the other hand, I remember this image from, I think it was Obama's first campaign. There was a rally against him and a woman was holding a poster that said, "Keep your socialist hands off my Medicare,"
right?
Which was accidentally hilarious. But it does show that the word itself is so loaded. Yeah. You think it can be redeemed or reclaimed?
Well, I didn't think that before the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016. And I did think that afterwards. I mean, the big argument at the time was, oh, well, he may be polling well, but if America found out about his socialism, they would turn on him. Well, he's still the most popular politician in America. The polls still show him defeating Donald Trump if he were to run in 2020 at 78 years old. I think it's obvious from that it isn't political suicide.
All right. What we've learned from polling is that if you describe a single-payer health system or call it Medicare for all, a majority of Americans are all thumbs up to that. Mm-hmm. If you call it socialized medicine or Obamacare, they are, "What's the matter with you? You commie."
The agenda, when it's explained to people, is very popular. I mean, Bernie Sanders did better in Trump voting districts in, you know, rural West Virginia and rural Michigan than Hillary Clinton did, even with his democratic socialist agenda, because he was able to go and he was able to explain what he meant by that. So that's why when Fox News puts the list of Ocasio-Cortez policies up on the screen.
Cortez is pushing for, let's see, single-payer universal health care, universal jobs, government-subsidized housing for everybody, tuition, free colleges.
They have trouble explaining why it's bad.
What you seem to be describing is galvanizing the principles of the Occupy movement into an ongoing political force.
Yeah, there was a very strong anarchist strain in the Occupy camps that was skeptical of anyone who ran for office, and a belief that if you ran for office, that was compromise with existing systems of power. And of course, Occupy kind of fizzled. I mean, it left a legacy, but the camps were cleared away and everyone had to go home and go back to work eventually. I think what you're seeing now is the spirit of Occupy, this sort of radical, almost utopian spirit, combined with a much more pragmatic sense of how to get things done politically. And I think Bernie Sanders was very inspirational there in showing that it seemed possible for people on the left to work within the Democratic Party and to take over offices in the Democratic Party. And Ocasio-Cortez is also proof of that. I'm going to Michigan this weekend to report on the Abdul el-Sayed gubernatorial campaign there, which is another part of this tendency to combine radicalism with a kind of pragmatism.
Now, you described the early part of the 20th century when not just here, but most of Europe was making a very big choice between capitalism and socialism that ended up in a lot of violence. But it wasn't quite as bellicose here, was it?
Well, what's interesting about that period is that you see a lot of the same debates on the left as are going on now. I've just been reading and writing about the American socialist movement, which has a fascinating sort of untold history, where there were actually 1,000 Socialist Party elected officials around the country in the period between about 1908 and 1912. And they included city councilmen, state legislators, 2 congressmen. There were 3 socialist mayors of Milwaukee. And there was the same debate among the Socialist Party of whether they were revolutionaries or reformists. So you had more radical Marxist socialists arguing that the socialist elected officials weren't sufficiently socialist because they were running on a platform of good government and owning municipal utilities and the 8-hour workday rather than overthrowing the bourgeoisie. But what's interesting is that the people who would sort of be the parallel to today's Bernie Sanders Democratic Socialists started doing quite well, making it into office. The socialists introduced lots and lots of bills in the state legislature in Wisconsin and Massachusetts, and they got quite a few bills passed, bills to regulate child labor, reduce working hours, that sort of thing. But it's an interesting parallel and also an interesting warning, because in the United States, the Socialist Party kind of tore itself apart with these debates without being able to come to a consensus about what they were. And also because the other political parties, interestingly enough, kind of took parts of the socialist agenda, which the socialists had normalized, like the reduction of working hours and the improvement of safety conditions in the workplace. And those things became standard parts of both the Democratic and Republican agendas, leaving the sort of moderate socialists without a platform.
Nathan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bob.
Nathan Robinson is editor-in-chief at Current Affairs magazine.
Coming up, the press corps has united against a common enemy. For now, even Fox.
This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Texas doctors confront the reality of the abortion ban.
A violation of the law could result in a first-degree felony charge and a fine of at least $100,000. After Roe was overturned, the message from doctors was, I'm out of here.
Revisiting the abortion laws in Texas. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, as we just heard, Republicans think Democratic Socialists are all wannabe Chavez-Maduro knockoffs. But according to a new study, appropriately titled The Parties in Our Heads, we don't necessarily know who's in the parties. The study's authors asked people to estimate the size of groups in each party. For example, what percentage of Democrats are black or lesbian, gay or bisexual? What percentage of Republicans earn more than $250,000 a year or are age 65 or older? Turns out, we don't really know. Perry Bacon is a senior writer for 538. He wrote about the study for his column, Secret Identity. He says there was a time when we assumed some diversity within the parties, but now each party presumes a set of beliefs, ethnicities, and even locations so extensive and fixed that party affiliation defines us more than almost anything else.
A couple decades ago, the parties were not well sorted. And what I mean by that is you had Democrats who were in the North who were pretty pro-civil rights. You had Democrats in the South who were anti-civil rights, but they were in the same party. We always had racial divides, but now the racial divides and the religious divides and the culture divides and the people who are very pro-women's rights are all in one party. And then the people who are more culturally conservative are in another party. And that means when you're sitting down having an argument at Thanksgiving about politics, we're not just arguing about taxes anymore, like if the tax rate should be this percent or this percent. We're talking about race and religion and identity and gender, too. And that's why people can't talk about politics with people from the other side, because they're really talking about these very personal things.
And as you observed, when you talk about the Thanksgiving dinner table and identity, it reminds me of negative partisanship, which you also talk about in your piece.
So what some surveys show is about 40% of people in each party. They're in their party not because they agree with their party and like their party, but because they really hate the other party. The Republican partisanship is a lot of times driven by hating Obama. And now a lot of Democrats are driven by hating Trump. And you can see how that would create a sort of a negativity cycle that is continuing. And I hope it doesn't extend to the next presidency, too.
Potentially, it's hatred of the Democrats that keeps many Republicans in the Trump camp, holding their noses, but they're sticking with them because the alternative is unbearable.
I guess what I would say is people view their partisanship as kind of core to their identity. I mean, Mitt Romney and Donald Trump are very, very different people with very different ideologies. If you recall, Mitt Romney in the campaign said, "Do not vote for Donald Trump." But most people who voted for Donald Trump, the overwhelming number of people who voted for Mitt Romney, what I think should happen is when your party changes positions on issues you care about, you should change parties. What's actually happening is people are reshaping their views around their party. And I think the big example of that being that Republican views on Russia are more favorable than they were 2 decades ago. And I think you can understand why.
2 decades ago.
You're right.
Two years ago. 2 years ago. Exactly.
Exactly. Right. Let me ask a couple others. A couple others I think are important. We saw in that poll, if you had asked a year ago, would you support a policy that results in parents being separated from their children, that would have been in the 6% zone. But I think because it became a position that Donald Trump had, majority Republicans have defended it.
Separating families at the border.
If that had been a Barack Obama stated policy, I don't think that would have been very popular. Mm-hmm. Once Barack Obama in 2012 said he was for same-sex marriage support jumped among African Americans. Mm. So that's another example that tells you that partisanship and what your party leader says, I think, really matters.
But the point of your piece and the reason why we called you is that Democrats and Republicans are frequently wrong in their perceptions of each other. And you cite the work of Douglas Aller and Gaurav Sood.
Right.
They had the polling firm YouGov ask American adults to estimate the size of groups in each party. And the results were kind of crazy and certainly counterfactual.
Right. For example, about 25% of Democrats are black. Republicans think about 46% of Democrats are black. Republicans think about a third of Democrats are lesbian, gay, or bisexual.
38%.
That number is like 6% in real life.
It turns out the Democrats are really wrong about Democrats, too. Didn't most of the Democrats polled think that over a quarter of the Democratic Party was gay or lesbian or bisexual?
Yes, these stereotypical groups were overestimated by even your in-party. Like, Democrats don't understand Democrats, but Republicans get Democrats even more wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And the flip side of that, I think people don't understand math and numbers. For example, most blacks are Democrats, but most Democrats are not black. And I think that's mm-hmm. partly why people struggle with this thing is the overwhelming number of white evangelicals are Republicans, but most Republicans are not white evangelicals.
The parties in our heads are not the parties in real life.
Exactly.
And so this sorting that seems to rule our heads and also our political media to a large extent can be terribly misleading. There are plenty of rural Democrats, plenty of young Republicans, even though Democrats think that Republicans generally are much older than they actually are. And there are evangelical Democrats. You know, right. I've met them.
Whites without college degrees, you keep reading about as the group that is really for Trump. And that's mm-hmm. true. They did vote for Trump. But that's such a big group of the country that a lot of them voted for Hillary, too, despite the media perception of that.
Mm-hmm. So what is the price we pay for not understanding how diverse the opposite party is or how diverse our own party is?
I worry about two things. Let's say if you live in Tennessee, you're white, you're fairly religious. I think the picture you have in your head from the media coverage is, I couldn't join the Democratic Party because no one believes in God there. But that's not really true at all. And if you're a young person who believes in low taxes, there's plenty of young people in the Republican Party, but the media coverage doesn't portray that. And I think we're just confusing people. There's a perception in the media that we missed the Trump wave because too many of us are in New York and D.C. That might be true, but I don't think what we're doing now is really the right answer to that. I read a lot of stories.
Oh, you mean we shouldn't have the media going out to red districts and saying, have you changed your mind yet? And we shouldn't have big stories in major newspapers that just reaffirm the prejudices of Democrats?
Yeah, I was looking up the data before I came on here. About 20% of people in the Bronx voted for Donald Trump. I don't think I've ever read about those people. And I would love to hear what they sound like, not because New York is a swing state, but because they would not be the kind of rural, hillbilly-ish people that are often portrayed as being Trump supporters. Rather than just roll up in small town West Virginia, we could do some polling and have a real sample of people who are Trump supporters. And some of these people work in office parks in suburban D.C. or live in the Bronx. Donald Trump would not be president without the strong support he got from white rural voters. But he also wouldn't be president if he didn't get most of the people who voted for mm-hmm. Mitt Romney who live in
right.
suburban Denver or suburban Atlanta or suburban Philadelphia. Like, those people are Republicans too, but they're not going to say those things that become a viral quote. They're not going to say Obama was born in whatever country. They're not going to make your story go viral in that same way, but they might give you a more nuanced picture of what's going on in America.
Don't you think a big problem is the red and blue way we color states? It renders the large number of rural working class people who voted Democrat invisible, and everybody gets tarred in liberal commentary with the same brush.
Not just that. I would argue our red and blue state divide leaves people in Houston or Atlanta or Louisville, Kentucky or Columbus, Ohio. You live in a big city, but it's not in a blue state. We sort of forget about you. 32% of the people in California voted for Donald Trump. This red and blue doesn't reflect sort of who we are. It's a big, complicated country full of people who maybe have the views we don't expect they do, but we're increasingly in this mode, I think, where you're Hispanic and you're from this state, so obviously you voted for Hillary. About one-fifth of Democrats are pro-life. About one-third of Republicans are pro-choice. Think about that. How many times do you hear a pro-life Democratic voice on TV or a pro-choice Republican voice, other than, you know, maybe Senator Collins on TV? So think about that. It's like the parties are making the country seem more partisan and divided than it actually is.
But partly it's because the party identification is so deep and the reporting is so binary that, you know, those people put in front of the cameras as once-in-a-lifetime oddities, freaks, would later be tarred and feathered. I mean, the fact is there is so much political coverage to the detriment of other kinds of coverage, and yet it doesn't factor in these numbers. It may cite them from time to time, but when it comes to offering opinion or sending out reporters, they're still guided by the stereotypes, and it's not very smart.
I think part of it is that if you wrote a story that has Republicans saying somewhat crazy, somewhat racist things, those stories tend to go viral mm-hmm. and get you more clicks. Since I've been doing critical coverage for about 15 years now, we have more people covering politics than I remember. And I think some of the best work at 538, some of the work at the Upshot at the New York Times, some of the work at Vox, some of the work that Ron Brownstein of The Atlantic does, some mm-hmm. of the work some of the writers about race and politics, like Van Newkirk at The Atlantic. There's some really sophisticated work, but there's also just a lot of stories that reinforce the sort of tribal identities of the parties.
And the way that the parties take advantage of that simplification, I just think the whole system is rigged to make us stupid.
I don't disagree with that. And I'm not sure how to unrig the system. I would encourage people who consume media to try to find articles that don't necessarily reinforce your positions all the time. I'm not saying you need to read like Breitbart if you're a liberal. Mm-hmm. But I am saying that you should try to click on things that are not the sort of, I hate Trump and this article is going to prove that he's going down and he's a lying, what have you. I thought a lot of the best writing about the Obama administration was Ta-Nehisi Coates of The Atlantic. And often he was saying on racial issues, Obama was not good enough. I think it's actually interesting criticism on the left often of Democrats and on the right of Republicans mm-hmm. that is actually captures a lot of nuance and is often fairly informative. Like if you read the Weekly Standard, they're not always anti-Trump, but they're not always pro-Trump. And it's actually a pretty useful publication to read in this era.
Perry, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Perry Bacon is a senior writer for 538. And now, the latest dispatch from the war on the press. This week, the president swapped his blunderbuss for a grenade, which he lobbed at CNN, CNN being the president's prime bugbear. His bête noir, his boogeyman.
In an unprecedented move, CNN correspondent Caitlin Collins was actually banned from a late afternoon press event in the Rose Garden because the White House simply didn't like the questions she asked the president earlier in the day.
Collins had been serving as pool reporter, there representing the five TV networks, which rotate their reporters to cover these photo ops in the hopes that the president will engage. It just happened to be CNN's turn.
Thank you, everybody.
Mr. President, are you worried about what Michael Cohen is going to say to prosecutors?
Let's keep going.
Are you worried about what is on the other tapes, Mr. President?
Thank you all. Let's keep going. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Why is Vladimir Putin not accepted your invitation?
Keep going. Come on. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, everybody.
This way, this way.
Let's go. Come on, guys. Thank you very much.
That's what reporters do at these things, nothing out of the ordinary. Until she was barred from an open press event in the Rose Garden because her questions had been deemed inappropriate, that's when the press got into formation. Fox News' Brett Baer.
As a member of the White House press pool, Fox stands firmly with CNN on this issue of access. So far, no response from the White House.
The White House has since responded. Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications and former Fox News honcho Bill Shine bounced from Fox for allegedly abetting sexual harassment at the network, charged fake news. Despite what the networks were claiming, he never said that the CNN reporter was banned from the open press event. She was merely, in the words of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, not welcome to participate. Politico's Jack Schaefer called it The Shining and said that the new communications chief was making the press corps great again. The New York Times' Peter Baker, The New Yorker's Susan Glasser, the White House press corps itself, and as noted Fox News, to name a few, stood shoulder to shoulder, which is notable because signs of media solidarity are rare. At a press conference with British Prime Minister Theresa May, Trump shut down CNN's Jim Acosta.
Mr. President, since you attack CNN, can I ask you a question?
John Roberts, go ahead, John.
Can I ask you a question?
No. John Roberts, go ahead. CNN's fake news. I don't take questions. I don't take questions from CNN. CNN is fake news. I don't take questions from CNN. John Roberts of Fox. Let's go to a real network. John, let's go.
Well, we're a real network too, sir.
Thank you, Mr. President.
The condemnation of Fox's John Roberts was swift. And so a few hours later...
I used to work at CNN. They have fine journalists there who risk their lives to cover the news around the world. And to say that they are not a real network or fake news is also unfair. So just wanted to add that in there.
After all, as his Fox colleague Brett Baer tweeted, back in 2009, when President Obama's administration left us out of round-robin interviews, CNN and Jake Tapper spoke out for us. As a member of the White House press pool on the news side, that's what's supposed to happen.
And on Thursday, the Treasury Department tried to exclude Fox News from pool coverage of interviews with one of its key officials. It backed down after strong protests from the press.
All the networks said, that's it. You've crossed the line.
Pete Vernon is a staff writer with the Columbia Journalism Review. This week he wrote, why the White House banning a CNN reporter actually matters.
I mean, you can go back to the campaign when Jorge Ramos was thrown out of a Trump event and no one in the moment stood up for him. He was thrown out pretty violently from that event.
You cannot deport 11 million people. You cannot build a 1,900-foot wall. You cannot deny citizenship to children.
Sit down, please. You weren't called.
I'm a reporter, and I have the right to ask a question.
Yes, you need an order.
I have the right to ask a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Trump.
Hi, Chip, yes.
They didn't just not stand up for the veteran reporter. They questioned his motives.
Jorge Ramos was acting like a journalist.
He disrespected the other journalists by cutting in front of them.
And I think that you notice that all of those reporters were right behind Mr. Trump saying, that's right. We're here. We're waiting our turn.
But that's true, but you don't.
Jorge, Donald Trump says you're an advocate, not a journalist. What's your response? Do you consider yourself to be an advocate?
I'm just a reporter asking questions.
It was troubling not to see people stand up for him. It was troubling in Donald Trump's press conference just before he became president not to see anyone stand up for CNN or BuzzFeed when he attacked them and called them names there. But as this administration has gone along and as these attacks on the press have escalated, I think journalists have adapted. And it's been really heartening to see the support and solidarity over the past week or so.
You know what? There's one thing that the media have never shied away from, which is describing every other gold dern moment as a turning point. Is this a turning point?
It's a good question. I don't know if this is something that we can expect to be seeing every week, someone yielding the floor in the press briefing, or, you know, I don't know whether Trump will provide moments where the press can stand in solidarity and say, you know what, this is bigger than any one outlet.
I'll tell you what my concern is that people will take to Twitter or Facebook or actually to their broadcasts or news organizations and object, but don't change their behavior in any significant way. Doesn't make the White House pay for the continuous attacks because they feel they have to pay constant attention to whatever the White House does, regardless of whether or not it's of any real significance.
All right. Is there really any way to make the White House pay beyond getting the public to care about this? And that goes back to the idea of saying, all right, this is why this is important. this administration is telling you, we're not going to allow certain perspectives, certain questions to be asked, and we're going to tell you not to believe what you see and hear. That idea that this is part of a bigger issue is, I think, the only way that you can get people to care, because otherwise it's just, you know, sort of inside baseball and journalists talking to each other.
Well, that never happens. She says on a media analysis show.
Exactly. And, no, coming from a media reporter at a niche publication focused on the media.
Thanks again, Pete.
No, thanks so much.
Pete Vernon is a staff writer with the Columbia Journalism Review.
Coming up, finding a culprit in the decimation of the New York Daily News.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In March 2016, the new chairman of the newspaper holding company, now known as Tronc, explained his business philosophy. It's not how you start, Michael Farrow said, it's how you finish. Well, on Monday, Chelsea Rose Marcia started her day as a plucky reporter for Tronc's New York Daily News, and she finished unemployed, along with half of the tabloid's newsroom. It was obviously a cruel blow, but on Monday afternoon at an impromptu wake in a downtown saloon, the 30-year-old staff reporter was struggling more with worry about how an entire city and world can be covered by the 45 souls who remain.
I mean, we were already cutting back on covering community board meetings and CCRB and those sorts of things. I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's just like, you know, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking.
The morning began with all the news interns shuttled to a theater for an unexpected showing of the movie Jurassic World. Once the coast was clear, their colleagues were ushered into conference rooms where 45 of them were abruptly cashiered. By noon, they'd reassembled in the bar for this forlorn revelry, both celebrating and bemoaning what they had lost. And, in further paradox, as unsurprised as they were shell-shocked, because this was merely the latest blow to the Daily News and to local journalism nationwide. 30 years ago, the Daily News employed 400 journalists. Meanwhile, in only the past 18 years, the number of U.S. newsroom jobs has been cut in half. The ad economy has long since collapsed, and newspaper profitability with it. Notably, Tronc's 2016 founding promise was more streamlined content delivery, helped by aggregation, which is not news gathering, and artificial intelligence, which is not question asking, and robots, which are not reporters, which Marcia says they all knew and suppressed.
To do your job every day, you can't really think about that. You have to be invested in the stories you're reporting on and the people you're reporting on and the people you're reporting for, my editors, my colleagues. So I think there is a little bit of a denial factor as you move along in it. You know it's happening, and you recognize it's happening, but you still have a job to do, and you can't dwell on the fact that this is what's going on in the background.
Tom LaForgia was a North Bronx kid who grew up loving the Daily News. It's wicked page one headlines, the feisty populist worldview, the whole strap hanger vibe.
There's a romanticism to it. It's cool, like punk rock a little bit, to get on the front page of a tabloid that still circulates respectable numbers and literally give Ted Cruz the middle finger. That sort of stuff is cool. And I was drawn to that, as I think a lot of my coworkers are. That is the New York City tabloid ethos, and it's unique in the world.
Not to mention the legacy of pugnacious investigative reporting, which as recently as last year earned to the paper a Pulitzer Prize for uncovering police abuses in apartment evictions of the poor.
It's as hard-nosed and fact-oriented as any respectable broadsheet you'll ever encounter. It's not like we have a lower burden of truth than anybody else because we like to make jokes. We're still journalism.
LaForgia was one of the lucky ones. He avoided termination by having already quit for an editing job in the Oxygen.com family of websites. Someone else who will stay employed at the News is Molly Crane Newman, the only experienced street reporter to show up for work that day and still have a job on Tuesday. At a wake, survivor's guilt is no fun either.
It's tragic, and there is, of course, this feeling that they're the ones who deserve to stay. They've been at this company a lot longer, in the game a lot longer than I have. I'm confused by it. I can't make sense of it.
Or how to cover a city of 8.6 million damn near all by herself.
I can't quite envision what the future is right now. We work in tandem with photographers, and the photographers have all been laid off. And I don't really have an answer to that question just yet. All I can say is that I'm going to do my best, and I understand the responsibility that I have.
In the 1950s and 60s, there was a TV show about New York.
There are 8 million stories in the naked city. This has been one of them.
Now there are 8.6 million stories in the naked city, and Molly, with maybe some help from artificial intelligence and trunk robots, will have to be content each day to tell one of them. That is, until the next round of cuts. Management thought that they were shielding the interns from Monday morning's cruelty, but at Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, they saw the same brutal show. I mean, what do you do with the dinosaurs?
Do these animals deserve the same protections given to other species? Or should they just be left to die?
This latest indignity to the New York Daily News has been widely decried as the toll of corporate parasites embodied by Trunk feeding on the few sickly survivors of local journalism.
Acknowledging his own differences with the paper, the mayor tweeted, "Trunk's greedy decision to gut the newsroom is bad for government and a disaster for NYC."
Unfortunately, I expected that this was going to happen once Trunk took over. The Trunk, of course, is the successor to the old Tribune Company.
I think because it can. Mm-hmm. I think because that's been its model at its other newspapers, is to cut and cut and cut.
But financial journalist Felix Salmon warns against such tidy narratives. Rather than looking for cartoonish evildoers, he says, we should be viewing this nightmare through the prism of sheer incompetence. Felix, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
If Trunk had somehow plundered the assets of the Daily News before these draconian cost-cutting measures, there, I guess, would be reason to demonize them. But they didn't sell off valuable stuff because there was no valuable stuff to sell off, eh?
They didn't make any money. They lost money. They've been subsidizing the Daily News for as long as they've owned it, which shouldn't have come as any surprise to them because it was losing money when they bought it. And at some point, they got sick of losing quite that much money, and so they decided to lose less. But they have never displayed any indication that they had any particular strategy or tactic or reason to buy the Daily News in the first place. And similarly, there's no particular strategy behind this latest round of cuts. It just seems to be a random cost-cutting measure in order to save on payroll in a couple of weeks' time.
Now, they only paid $1 for the New York Daily News, but they acquired, in addition to its name and its business, such that it is, a whole mess of liabilities.
They have to print and distribute that paper every day, which is incredibly expensive, and they have inherited a bunch of contracts which oblige them to do so. It's really hard to get out of those contracts. You can't just stop printing one day. It's much easier, if you need to save money, to lay off journalists, even though journalists are not really the expensive part of the Daily News.
Now, on top of all of the other obstacles facing profitable local journalism, there also are the newsprint tariffs that the Trump administration opposed on Canadian paper manufacturers that has further increased the cost of printing paper daily newspapers and making the already unaffordable more unaffordable still.
I think that might actually have been part of the reason why they cut journalists is because they decided that with the price of newsprint rising, they were going to have to cut pages. And if you're going to cut pages, that means you're going to cut journalists.
Now, the people who bought the assets of Tribune Media and renamed it Trunk, you know, they got some decidedly unthriving properties in the LA Times, in the Chicago Tribune. Then they added to it the New York Daily News. You know, I guess the best question I can give you is, what do you suppose they were thinking? This is like going long in coal mines.
It's the classic strategy, Bob, that you can tie two stones together and expect that they're going to float. If you combine a bunch of crappy money-losing businesses, magically they'll start making money. No one's been able to do that in the past, but hope springs eternal, especially when you're run by a bunch of morons.
Perhaps moron is, it's a little less judgmental over in the United Kingdom than it is here. But you think that their motives and their ambitions did not quite match the reality of their acquisitions. What do you think were their ambitions?
I think their time horizon was about 17 seconds. I don't think they're smart enough to have grand strategic ambitions. But insofar as they did have ambitions, what they wanted to do was have distribution across millions of readers in all of the major media markets in the country, which certainly include both Los Angeles and New York and also Chicago. And once they reach all of these affluent markets, they can serve up a bunch of hashtag content to all of these people using artificial intelligence and computers and cheap labor and something, something. I don't think this is thought through, but ultimately they can make money somehow. If this was to work, it would only work as a scale play. And so in that sense, they needed to get bigger, otherwise they would die. But on the other hand, the bigger you get, the more money you lose, and the more money you lose, the more quickly you die. So you kind of die either way.
Now, we've spoken before this, and I know that your suspicions are that they were more attracted to the sort of glamour of being newspaper tycoons than they were to the actual expectations of turning these into profitable businesses.
Almost no one buys a newspaper out of purely avaricious intent. You know, if you want to make enormous amounts of money in the world, there are much easier ways of doing it than buying a newspaper. Buying a newspaper gets you a certain amount of social cachet. You get to decide who the paper endorses in the presidential election and feel important that way. And all of these motivations go into the decision to buy any newspaper, whether you're Jeff Bezos or whether you're Trunk. But in the case of Trunk, I think probably it was more incompetence than it was any kind of civic-minded desire to make sure that high-quality journalism reached the thriving city of 8 million people.
There is this frantic search for revenue streams and an overall business model for newspapers in the wake of the collapse of the advertising market. You mentioned the New York Post. That's one model. Having a billionaire who's willing to lose $60 million a year because that's just shake and change out of the sofa cushions for him, and Rupert Murdoch wants to be a newspaper baron. Outside of that, is there any sustainable, ethical business model for newspapers and the local journalism that goes with it?
It's hard to see one, to be honest. I think that a very smaller scale in the very small cities, large towns, Warren Buffett has a bunch of small local newspapers which seem to be doing sort of okay journalism and making a small profit, and he's happy doing that. So it's not completely impossible, but in a massive market the size of New York, it's hard to see how you can really compete and get the kind of scale that you need by serving up local news. Local news has never been that sexy. It's never been the kind of thing that people are really going to drop everything else they're doing and run off to read an article about the local city council. So much as it's valued and incredibly important, and democracy kind of fails without it, I hate to say it, but it's really hard to see how it can be profitable.
All right, one last thing. I described the cuts at the New York Daily News as draconian. And you're kind of rolling your eyes because you come from a different society with a much more colorful way of describing...
In England, it's almost compulsory when describing these kind of cuts to describe them as swinging. That's a much better word.
Well, I got to say, you give good swinge, Felix. thank you very much.
Thank you.
Financial journalist Felix Salmon is the host of the podcast Slate Money. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, and John Hanrahan. We had more help from Meg Harney, Yasmin Khan, and Asta Chaturvedi. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Greg Rippon and Sam Baer.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.